This is the Amp Hour Podcast, recorded July 15th, 2012. Episode 104, Kempt, Kickstarter, Kakorafiaphobia.
Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Dave Jones from the EEV blog.
And I'm Chris Gammel of Chris Gammel's Analog Life.
What's up, Chris?
Morning, Dave. Not much around here.
Oh, that's not terribly exciting. I've been pretty excited recently.
Yeah, playing with your new scope, right?
Playing with a $140,000 oscilloscope. It's not every day you get to do that.
Is that all? Yeah.
Yeah, it's only $140,000 Australian dollars. Not sure what goes for in the US, you know.
Yeah. It's chump change, right? I mean,
yeah, that's right. For some companies, yeah. It's. I always had it lying around, you know. I completely forgot.
Yeah.
Gathering
man, that's
dust.
Crazy. That's crazy.
You want to know what the crazy thing is, right?
That?
Is if this was actually mine, and I was bullshitting about lying around gathering dust, of course, if it really was, it actually would, if I really have had this in my lab for keepers, it would actually sit around gathering dust.
Yeah.
I would not use it.
It's got too much horsepower, right?
It's got too much horsepower. The fan is like a wind tunnel, sounds like a bloody wind tunnel,
mm-hmm.
right? And the horrible touchscreen Windows XP interface makes you want to... You know, go out and kill yourself. It's horrible.
Yeah, you know that's it's interesting because of the high cost ones are really low volume, so you got to figure that they don't get as much optimization as like a low cost Rigol. Well, not even that's really low cost, but even just a high run kind of piece of test equipment gets the most attention probably because they get the most regular Joes kind of being like, oh, and why doesn't it do this and that when I touch the screen? And yeah.
So. And the people who design the thing, the systems engineers who design this beast, you know, they go, well, we're not going to waste our time making it user-friendly. Geez, you know, we need to get the performance is the only thing that matters, you know, the performance and the
spec,
features.
Right?
Yeah. You know, yeah, that's it, you know. And it's got all these weird, you know, and it's not just, this oscilloscope's not designed just to get a waveform on the screen. It's designed to do automated analysis
of,
serial, signals. Yeah, you use them in these standards labs where if you're designing some sort of high-speed SATA hard drive or something like that, you've got to make sure it meets the SATA spec and stuff like that.
Right.
And this is the kind of machine that has software. It's probably not built in. It's probably got to pay a lot extra for it, but it will, analyze and make sure it meets all the spec. You know, it'll analyze all the jitter and, take 10 billion measurements and make sure it's all...
That's insane.
I'm not kidding.
No, I know you're not. That's...
I've had to do SATA testing before, but we used our own in-house software to run jitter, and I'd leave the thing running for days,
really?
It would just keep sampling, and measuring that jitter to make sure it's all good and giving you that, error rate figure, and that's what you care about.
I talked to a guy that actually used to design the oscillators that go into that thing, because you think about how big is the sample rate for that?
40 gig sample per 40 second, each channel.
Yeah, you figure you have to have a very high rate of, oscillator, and it's got to be really precise too. And so you start getting into these crazy physics. I mean, yttria coated. I'm probably totally wrong about that. Even
unobtainium doped.
That kind of thing.
Transistors.
They're definitely working.
It's crazy
with,
stuff.
PhD students, in high end research kind of stuff, and it's kind of interesting.
And you can't just go to DigiKey and buy these parts.
Oh,
right?
No,
they're
gotta
all
make the
hand
parts,
rolled,
really.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, you got to, and that's really a competitive advantage then too, right? You got to make this crazy stuff
and then
build a scope
around
signal analyzer around it, whatever. So, it's crazy.
Madness, and that's why they cost so much because, each, input transistor is, manufactured by nude virgins with, with Oompa Loompas dancing
around, singing
songs, and then each one's individually tweaked by the ghost of, Bob Pease, while he's rubbing his beard, right?
That's nice. I like that. Yeah. It's a heck of a visual.
Right.
An audio picture.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
But as you know, anyway, the good thing about that is that you don't feel jealous. You know, I'm not jealous of that because I don't have anything I need to measure that with. I mean, like 50
here.
Megahertz scope, and that's fine with me. I don't care. You know, like even that's probably more than
I'm
doing.
A nice 500 is, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's good for digital stuff. But I mean, for how much I use it here at home, it's like, well.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that's like. When you need it, you can rent it. That's the real thing. And I think a lot of people do that anyways, because owning, I don't know, I almost went to work with a company that was doing high-speed transceiver stuff, and you need that. That was a huge part of their R&D budget was just test equipment. And it's rough, man. You got to, the business side, it's like you got to budget properly. And then, you know, if you're working there, that means you got to sign up for time on the test equipment. I'm sure you've had to do that in the past, right?
We
You know, like, oh, well, 2 o'clock in the morning, it's free. Go ahead.
Oh, man. Have you ever been in a company that just, you know, it pisses money away, like there's no tomorrow on these rentals? Like, you'll rent it because they actually have it available now, right? You'd need it today, right? And, of course, the supply, especially in Australia, it's probably different in the US, but in Australia, right, not many of the suppliers carry stock, right, of, you know, either an obscure bit of test gear or a high-end bit. So, you know, or they've got the loaners out. Somebody else like me has got the loaner, you know, and you can't get it tomorrow. So you go to these rental companies thinking, oh, yeah, we'll just rent it for a couple of days. And then 2 years later, right, someone from accounts comes in and goes, do we still need this bit of gear? You know, and we've paid for it like 100 times over.
If we get rid of this, we can hire more people, right?
Yeah, we can hire more
people. Like 10 more people.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And they wonder where all the budget has been pissed away.
Right.
Because, you know, it's under some other budget which disappears into the ether. You know, and everyone forgets about it, you know, and of course the machine is still being used because it's here, right? And nobody, your average Joe engineer doesn't care who paid for it, where it came from or how long we got it for.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, it's just a piece of test gear, right?
He's
flipping
right.
signals with a switch or something and he's measuring it.
And there's only one person in the company who knew that was a rental, you know, and they just keep their mouth shut because they don't care, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, and you know, that's why the lease companies exist too. They know
they make
that
a fortune.
It looks like a really crappy business to start with, but then because you know they're always having new equipment and everything, and they swap out equipment a lot, and they have a lot of high costs. But then you get like a high end rental like that, you know, it's $1,000-$2,000 a month, and then it just sits there. You know, the contract just keeps getting renewed because of whatever reason. And once you're in somewhere, then it's just cash machine,
gold mine.
You know,
you could pay.
I mean, you could pay the cost. They're probably getting discounts anyways on the test equipment. Or you know, I was actually looking at a 3D printer for that kind of thing. And you know, like you pay off the thing, and then it's just gravy after that. So, and they're probably financing it too. You know, they're just taking out loans or whatever. So,
yep.
Oh yeah.
Speaking of 3D printers,
yeah,
I'm finally getting my new MakerBot replicator.
You're getting
it's
one?
Currently in Memphis, Tennessee.
Really? That's cool.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll see how an out-of-the-box MakerBot goes.
Oh, that's right, because it ships all together, right?
Mm. And, and Charles from MakerBot just designed this cute-looking case for my microcurrent. It looks really neat, you know, a little low-profile case. Awesome.
Yeah.
Got myself a useful little
you tweet that earlier. So.
Yeah.
That's cool.
And then you realize where the hell I was, right?
Well, yes, I did.
I was a bit late for today's show,
Yeah,
folks.
That's okay. These things happen. They do. Mm. That's cool, though. Yeah, so that's on Thingiverse. We'll link that in.
Yep.
But yeah, that's great. And it just because, you know, I didn't actually realize about the microcurrent to start with that it was actually all just single PCB. I think we probably talked about it since, but...
right.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, I use it as a front panel and the parts are mounted on the back. And I did that for my new... micro supply as well, and my micro calc too. I've done it for three different projects, although the micro supply is changing in that respect. But if you see my prototype, I've flashed around on the videos that I did a couple of years back, then they were all, you know, parts mounted on the back, and it kind of looks groovy, right? Because all of the tracks can't be on the single sided, although it is on the microcurrent because it's so simple, right? So it's a single-sided layout, effectively, right? There's no tracks going on the top half. But a more complicated one like the microcurrent, of course, with, you know, multiple digit displays and all sorts of things, you know, you need tracks to run on the other side. And you don't want to go to a four-layer board and hide the tracks, because then you've just killed your cost advantage, right, of going to a, you know, using the one board for your front panel and your components too. And so you have the tracks going through to the front, but they kind of look funky, you know, when the tracks integrated with your front panel. Because it kind of looks high techy if you do it right. Like you can do it wrong, good funky, it kind of looks neat, you know, because these tracks are running around on your front panel.
I kind of like it, dope head with veins running through the front.
It's really quite neat.
I saw that MakerBot was actually at Comic-Con. I saw this funny picture. Yeah, I don't know why. They had a picture of Seth Green, the guy from the Austin Power movies. Voices for Family Guy. But yeah, the picture of him. And it's weird thinking about, you know, like where that stuff all gets mashed together. I'm not sure why they were there. I didn't read about it at all, but just thinking about when that technology actually does interact with larger scale public, how it all works and stuff. You know, it happens a lot at what's that January conference, the CES.
Oh yeah,
and that's all gadget stuff, but it's still kind of cool. And with Kickstarter and everything, there's tons of high profile stuff now. Anyways, I mean, there's high profile projects that anyone could buy. Support.
It's just nuts.
So,
and speaking of Kickstarter,
yeah, we actually had a little thing about that, huh?
A mate of mine, Marcus Chappie from Hiddlebird Electronics. He's got a component and kit supply business here in Sydney, and he's done these Ninja Blocks, which you may have heard about.
I have.
And he did the Kickstarter thing, of course. You know, like, he's got a friend in the US, because Australians can't do the Kickstarter. You need someone. You need an Australian. You need an American.
You need a front man,
Patsy. to actually.
Right. So if you see me with a Kickstarter, you might know where it came from, people.
Right. Exactly. He'll be fishing off his 10%.
Sure. Don't stop there, buddy. Yes.
There's a couple of interesting things here. A is that he used Kickstarter, of course, and he did like 670 of them or something, and he's still making them satisfy the orders that rolled in from the Kickstarter. The interesting thing is that the case for these Ninja Blocks is actually 3D printed. And his house is apparently full of 3D printers just running 24/7 printing out these cases.
Yeah, manufacturing revolution takes a while. It's not easy. Not easy to do. Do you know how long the print takes?
I don't know, but just based on it, from the looks of it, each one I'd say would take a minimum of 40-50 minutes. Something I don't think he'd get away with under half an hour.
That thing's in the palm of your hand.
It'd be
there.
An hour, probably.
Oh yeah, I think more than that, but
probably, yeah.
I think probably 5 or 6 hours for that kind of thing.
Oh, I don't know. I don't think it's that long. I've done fairly large stuff which takes like 2 hours. So,
all right, well,
you know, yeah, I yeah.
I am
anyway,
inexperienced
it,
in that
let's,
way, so.
let's say it's an hour per case. Yeah. You know, it's to fill an order of 675. That's let's say it's 1,000 printing hours.
Yeah.
You know, for one single machine. That doesn't include handling and all the rest of it.
Right.
Yeah, 3D printed cases. Folks, not such a good... They
look
funky,
you already had them, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it looks great. It looks really funky, and it does exactly what you want. They've got a little, you know, ninja symbol sort of carved into it, and it does look great.
Yeah.
But, yeah, from... When you've got
you compare it to a injection mold, right? I mean,
oh, of course,
the mold would be really expensive, but once you get them, I mean,
exactly. You can churn these out for 10 cents a pop, And that's the interesting thing. He now has the money to do it because he got venture capital funding. Yay, Marcus! Good on you.
Right, which is kind of crazy. So we should explain the difference here too. So he did a Kickstarter. He was funded through Kickstarter. He did started the project, and now. He had some venture capitalists who are, you know, very important persons, apparently, that, you know, come and say, we want to give you all this money as angels or whatever else, and we're going to get a chunk of your company.
I don't think they came to him. I think he went in search.
No, he said they came to him in the article.
Oh, did it? Oh, okay. Yeah. I didn't read the article.
Because it said he was trying to find funding in Australia first.
Right.
Okay. And then later, once he got funded, they came in.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right. So these venture capital angel investing firms, there's tons of them now apparently, and then they're sniffing around Kickstarter looking for the next cool thing. And they
right. Yeah. And that really kind of, you know, that's going to have a lot of problems, right? But it also kind of sweetens the deal too, right? I mean, it's very interesting what could come out of that. I don't know.
It did. But yeah. I tweeted him about it, and he tweeted back saying, oh, now it's a lot of work, you know? Now I've got to, because he's got to run his Little Bird Electronics as well as running this Ninja Block startup now. It's like, be careful what you wish for.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And actually, Nathan Seidel from SparkFun, he wrote about that. He wrote about he talked about it at the open source hardware convention. Mm-hmm. But it's called, in his talk, he called it the pit of despair, and then he just recently posted an article about it as well.
Oh, okay. We'll have to link that in.
Yes, definitely. And basically, he said there's like three levels. He said there's like the little one-offs, right, where you're on Kickstarter and you do like a little device and you just barely fund it. And then there's the really successful ones, like the Pebble Watch was just $10 million, and then you quit your job and that's your full-time gig, right? You're basically moving to China or you're going to try and do it wherever you are. And then he called the middle one the pit of despair, and it's interesting.
Is the pit of despair where you haven't got enough money to hire a team of people to take care of it for you, and then you don't have to worry about it, and where you have to do everything, and you're working 24/7, and your marriage falls down, and you is that the pit of despair?
That's what he was calling kind of thing where it was like an overwhelming kind of thing, right? And ironically, he used one of our past guests as an example of the pit of despair. He used Ian Danaher and Nonolith Labs. So actually, Ian is posting a response tonight, which I got a little preview to. But basically, he's calling it the pit of opportunity, because basically they launched their company out of it. And, it's a lot of hard work, but I was kind of talking back and forth with him before, and I brought up something that I had heard something else somewhere else. It's like, well, they call it hardware because it's hard, right? I mean, like,
of course,
that is like the basis behind it. If you have a product, it's not easy to put stuff together. And, Ian's writing about how he knew that, but he did it anyways, and all the learning he got from it anyways. So it, I don't know. It's a good article. I have a preview of it. And so that'll be posted later tonight. I'll post a link to that as well. I think that'll be good as like a good dialogue back and forth, kind of these I wouldn't call them shots across the bow, but Nathan sees it from SparkFun, right? They see actually talks about it in the article about they're actually getting people coming to them saying, help me make this kit.
Uh-huh.
And you think about how many people they have to turn down.
It'd be countless numbers.
Right. I mean, doing a turnkey kind of operation like that, I mean, that's never easy, right? Contract manufacturing is not an easy thing to do.
No, and, it's a dog of a business, actually.
Right, it's not high margin, right? No one wants to give you margin. Yeah. And, and because you think about it, you could charge up front, you could charge, high margins up front where you're doing prototypes, right? But then eventually, if there's anyone worth their salt on the business side of things from the people buying these finished goods from a contract manufacturer, they're saying, no, I'm not paying you this much, and then they just thump on them, and they threaten them, and that's just what purchasing does, right? They're good at that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Yeah, be careful what you wish for.
I don't know. Do you know of any...
Well, and you start out wanting to help people, and then you get inundated, It's like...
Well, yeah. Yeah. I mean...
Well, I'm in a similar position where I get so many requests for help that I just have to turn everyone down.
Mm-hmm.
It's just...
Like,
you know,
once in a while,
there
might be a rare opportunity, but still, it gets lost in the noise.
Oh, look, I've got this great opportunity. Can you help me design this product? And we'll give you shares, and we'll do this, and we'll do that, and we'll, and it's like, well, no, sorry.
Right. You know? At that point, it's like, I'd rather be a venture capitalist. I'll just give you money. You go figure it out.
Yeah, exactly. I wish I had money to be able to, that'd be great. If I had 50 million bucks, I'd love to.
Yeah, if you were good at, like, recognizing.
Be able to help people out with... invest. I can see that. I can see why these, people who make these fortunes in their .com, you know, start up and happen to sell out at the right time. They're worth $100 million. I can see why they do this.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be fun. I would. That's probably what I'd do if I had this much money. I'd be, you know, that'd be my full-time job, is trying to find little, you know, startups to invest in, I think.
Yeah. Now, I saw a thing from Elon Musk who he started PayPal, and people probably know who he is. But he said he sold PayPal for $180 million. He put $100 million into SpaceX. He put $70 million into Tesla. And then he put $10 million into SolarCity, which is the leasing of solar cells. And he said he had trouble making his rent when he did that.
Yeah, I know.
That's a sign of a crazy person. Like, I love that. That is awesome.
I just watched the other night Revenge of the Electric Car. And he's in it. They actually follow him around with the camera.
Nice.
And when Tesla's actually almost going under, like, they actually let the cameras into the room where he was. He had to call in all the people who had pre-ordered these Teslas, right?
Yeah.
They each paid like $100,000 up front. And then he had to go in and tell them, look, we need more money, otherwise the company's going under and you won't get your cars. And
that has got to be a bad day. That is a bad day.
And he was saying, he was sitting there, and you could see the look of stress on his face, and he's going, I just had to transfer $2 million from my account so that we could pay the wages, and now I'm practically broken, you know. That was my last $2 million or something like that, you know, that he just put into Tesla to pay the wages.
Awesome.
I know.
That is so awesome.
And you can see the stress on his face, and it's like,
yeah.
Oh, man. And he was going through a divorce at the time, and he had four kids, and he was trying to juggle SpaceX as well. And he's, you know, telling everyone at Tesla, look, you know, call me at 2 a.m. in the morning. I don't care, you know, look, we have to get these cars out. And he's going around inspecting each one of the cars personally, and
oh man,
you know,
that's killer.
They had so many problems. Anyway, great doco. If you want to watch it, I'm sure you'll love it, Chris.
I would love to get him on the show sometime. So if anyone has any connection,
yeah, dream
at
on,
all
yeah.
If you know
this
anybody,
have a free hour. Yeah, right.
Oh, you know? I doubt he does.
I'm sure he would love to be on, you know, if he I'm sure we could
yeah,
convince him to be on the show if he had a free hour.
Yeah, or really anyone, you know, from Tesla, too. That would just be interesting to hear Bomer about the car. Man. But if anyone knows, let us know. You know, send us an email.
Right,
or
if anyone's got you right, if anyone thinks you could be on.
Yeah. I do have one former coworker that works there now. I'll have to give him a shout.
Okay, right.
But actually, there was a bet that went on, too, about the, because Tesla just released their Model S, which is their sedan. And so it's like half the price of the Sportster and yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. And he made a bet with someone. He said, if it was a journalist, and the journalist said, you know, if I win, you have to donate. Or I think Elon said that if I win, you have to donate $1 million. And the other way around. Then he realized, as a journalist, he said, okay, if you lose, you have to donate $1,000. And so the journalist ended up losing because they got the car out on time and it actually works.
Yeah,
and,
nice.
Yeah, it's a slick looking car too. I guess 300 miles. That's the crazy thing.
That's awesome. But have they actually produced it? Because that was the problem with the Tesla. They just underestimated how hard it was to actually manufacture a car. You know, they could make their prototypes, no problems, but mass manufacturing almost killed them. You know,
we're complaining about boards and now this and that.
Yeah, I know, exactly.
Like, oh, jeez. You know, that physical goods is very difficult to make.
They're an incredibly a car is an incredibly complex machine, especially one that, you know, people expect to look and work like the latest Japanese cars. You know, they expect them to be perfection and
safe,
you know,
and everything. Yeah,
and
they have
safe
to pass all the regulations,
high tech, and all single part in there polished and
plus if you're paying $50,000 or $100,000, you want it to be super fancy inside. So, you know, like, you're probably spending all the time working on the drivetrain and all the important stuff, and then people are like, oh, well, I'm paying $100,000, I need it to have infotainment systems.
Yep.
Barf.
That's right.
I hate that word so much.
There was this funny point in this doco where Elon's in the factory inspecting each car, because each car had some sort of problem with it, you know, and he's inspecting this one and talking to the guy who was trying to fix it, you know, and you know, he was saying, oh, look, something wrong with the drivetrain. Oh, look, just rip it out and put in a new one. We need to ship this damn thing. And then there was some guy he hadn't met, he was standing nearby, and he said, that's my car. And Elon looked around and went, That's your car, is it? Oh, right. Well, you've just heard from the top. There you go. We, we're going to put you in a new drive shaft and you'll have it tomorrow. And then they showed the, you know,
that thing's a
video
of
the truck delivering his car tomorrow. You know?
Oh, yeah.
And wow. It was like, ah, oh, man, how could you do that? How could you, you know, trying to run SpaceX as well as trying to individually inspect every car that goes out the line. It's just, the guy did not sleep, clearly.
Right.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
I'm not going to complain anymore.
Anyway, the guy has my utmost respect.
Yeah, me too. And plus, man, I mean, they modeled Iron Man off of him, right? Tony Stark.
Yeah, they did.
That's pretty cool.
And he had a cameo in it. If
he did, in the
it.
Second one, yeah.
In the second one, that's right. Yeah. So, anyway, we've diverged from Marcus's little startup.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he got like $1 million or something.
Yep,
which does
bucks.
Sound like a lot, but in
oh,
the end, folks,
salaries
it's
really
not
quick.
Once you pay your own wages and maybe the wages of one or two others, and then you pay for molds at $50,000 a pop or something, you know, the mold to do this little ninja block, which I'm sure is what the money's for, you know, really is to work, A, work on it, hire people to work on it, and B, you know, trying to get this thing mass produced because, you know, they can't keep 3D printing the things. So,
right.
You know,
yeah, you think about the cost of people, right? I mean, I never really got that either, but I actually sat in with a upper level manager at one point. They were just kind of explaining budgets and stuff like that. And they said, you know, like you think about, you know, top end engineer, right? Maybe making $100,000 in the Midwest, you know, cause that's kind of top end around here.
Yep.
And, you know, you take that and then you add on healthcare and you add on all the benefits and everything like that. And even their like bench equipment in a year. And they say they estimate it like $150,000-$200,000 per person. And at $1 million, that's 5 people for a year. That's nothing else. I mean, you don't get anything else at that point.
No. So, you get no molds, you get no parts, you get no nothing.
Right. Yeah. You don't realize how much money people are almost always one of the biggest costs. I mean, like NRE kind of stuff, like molds and you know, like for early run protos is significant cost, and test equipment is a big cost. But man, like people's it. That's where the good stuff comes from. So
that's why they lay off people and they don't lay off equipment.
That's right.
Yeah. that's what happens.
Right. Yeah. Well,
we're
ninja blocks
expensive.
Are cool though. These are so the ninja blocks are sensor based stuff, right?
Well, yes. The idea is you can hook any sort of sensor up to them, and then they connect to the cloud.
Right. Yeah, and they're based on the BeagleBone, correct?
Something like that. They're based. Yes, I think it is based on that.
I think
so
they
obviously they won't be using the BeagleBone. They'll be rolling their own because that's open source. So they'll be able to just roll their own and yep. But of course, they will have to give back.
Yeah,
you know, these venture capitalists have to understand that you have to release all the design files back if you're going to base it on the BeagleBone.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
That's got to be an interesting conversation when, you know, like you have investors who are like, well, we gave you all this money, so where's our money? It's like, well,
where's our patents? You know,
we have to
set aside $100,000 to get this patent. Where's the what? We can't patent it?
Yep.
Are you kidding me?
Yep.
Well, we can trademark the name. That's about it. You know?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
That might be I'm guessing they probably brought that up at the front, you know, like, well,
probably.
Give us as much money as you want, but might be a while.
And I'm sure, you know, I'm sure the manufacturing is going to move out of Marcus's bedroom now into, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Into China, I'm sure, because they have to produce these things, mass volume and low cost, because that's the only way it's going to take off, you know. Because that's the idea, is that this is almost a consumer-level device. That's why these venture capitalists smell blood, right? Is because, there's, you know, that huge potential to be, it'll be the next Christmas gift everyone wants, you know?
Right.
It'll be the next, you know, Tickle Me Elmo.
Yep.
All right. So. Oh, boy.
There's actually
anyway,
one other.
Good luck,
one
Marcus.
Other. Oh, no, that's not going to work. never mind. Speaking of things being made, did you see that link I posted about how ceramic capacitors are made?
No, I didn't. Please share the link.
Yeah,
and
I found this really,
at it now.
Really interesting article from Johnson Dielectric. So I can only assume that they make they make capacitors, which is their marketing's working.
Haven't heard of them.
I have neither, but maybe they just make the dielectrics and sell them.
Ah, right. You know. Okay. Got it.
But yeah, they go through the whole process of like how they actually put it all together, and you know, this is another another this is how the sausage is made kind of thing, right? You don't really need to know how this is happening, but it's pretty interesting. It's a screen printing process, and then there's like a ceramic powder and slurry, and then they kind of just pour it in a mold, and then they actually like cut it up. You know, like I never would have thought that that's they cut it up and then they you know they laminate layers, they push this goop into there, and then they
goop,
yeah the
technical
goop
term.
Right. Yeah. Or actually no, they lay the goop down first in layers, sorry, and then they take these sheets, they laminate them all together, and then they cut them up. So it's actually you'd actually see layers of this stuff, right? You know, that's like, and then they actually cap the end and they bake them out and. I don't know. It's pretty cool. I never even thought about it. You know, it's like, oh, well, they just.
No, it's.
They have some process, right?
But you can just imagine the trial and error which went into, you know, doing that and trying to get it right and trying to perfect it. Not only the manufacturing process, but the actual technical side of actually, you know, getting the performance you wanted as well. It's just, you know.
Right, and then you
so
start
so much trial and error,
and then you start playing with you know the chemistries and stuff. Like I've noticed lately, I've been doing stuff with like 0603s, 0402s, and I've been trying to see how much I can get in. You know, you can actually get like a 10 microfarad. I think it was an 0402, but it was
I think you can get a 10.
It's like 0402. It's like a 3-volt rated.
Oh yeah,
you know,
it's a
capacitor.
Very low voltage. Yeah, so the dielectric thickness is like you know half a bee's dick.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
It's tiny.
Yeah. And it's for like decoupling, right below a chip or something, right? That's the reason you're doing it. But I mean, if you're using like 010 halves or however you say that, you know, there's 0201 and then the next one down is how do you say it? You say 0105.
I don't work that low, so no. You know,
no. Yeah, I've seen stuff. You know, you see it more on consumer level stuff. Definitely there. I mean, I was looking at some teardowns of. The new Google stuff that just got released, like the one they worked on with Asus, the pad, what are they calling it? The Nexus 7 pad.
Yep.
That was pretty cool. And these boards are just ridiculously small. You know, just how much, it's all battery, basically. It's all battery and screen now. So now you get like the outside edge, whatever the battery isn't now.
Right.
You get that for your boards, and there's not much in there. You know, I mean, there's a ton in there, but it's all mostly on silicon now. It's all integrated Broadcom chips and everything.
But the thing is, you don't want to go down to those, you know, those level components unless you absolutely have to, because the yield, you know, the machines, you've got to use the top line machines, and the yield is trying to perfect it to get it right is just horrid.
Right.
You know, you're really creating a lot of trouble for yourself. So only if you absolutely have to.
Right.
Otherwise, stick with 0402 or something, folks, really.
Oh yeah, and even that. I mean, like for rework and stuff, like that starts. Yep. You definitely need a microscope. And
Well, there's a bit of a machine. Well, I think we've talked about this before. There's a bit of a jump between an 060. Every pick and place machine will do 0603 as a minimum. But then there's a bit of a jump to the 0402s. Not all of them can do that. And then you've got to have the special heads to do it, and you know, your yield's not as great. So even that jump from 0603 to 0402 can have consequences in your manufacturing.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you don't need to go that low, don't.
Oh, yeah.
Stick to 0603.
Are you doing mostly 0603 these days?
I do 0603 for everything as standard, yep.
Yeah, yep. I'm moving
to if I need, like, higher power or something, I'll go to 1206 or 0805. Like, if I need my 10 mic cap, for example, then I'll go to 0805, because then you'll be able to get, you know, a cheaper one in the larger package. So
yeah, that's a good trade-off. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. And yeah, you know, I'm going to a real, the stuff I'm working on is really space constrained these days. And so everything's 0402. I don't think I'm going to go lower than, I don't think 0201 is really necessary.
No, it's not worth it unless you're doing a hearing aid or a, you know, something like that.
Right. Yeah. And you know, the problem with all this stuff though is actually, so I'm actually pulling in these new parts, you know, this thing I'm working on, it's like all the previous stuff that that's at my company has not been that. It's been larger stuff. So I actually have to register all this
through
stuff.
Through hole.
Well, it's not through hole, but but you know, like,
come on, it was Keithley, man.
Well, some of the old stuff, Keithley, I guess. But no, but you know, it's interesting, you know, dealing with the engineering, like the part side of things, like the registration stuff. Do you do that now at all for your stuff? I mean, how are you actually? When you're placing a new component, are you just, you know, doing it at the time when you print out your BOM. You're just finally registering parts and figuring out what you'll need. When do you do that personally?
It's ad hoc. It's a real mess. I need to automate this better. But, you know, yeah, new parts is a pain in the ass, but you got to. Every new design seems like it needs, 10, 20 new parts on it.
Yeah.
That I don't have in my library. So I got to create the footprint. I got to create the schematic. Then I manually insert it in my BOM spreadsheet. I don't have, my CAD program linked to my BOM and generate it that way. I know I should, but,
You don't have it at the end?
I've got a manual spreadsheet, which I have to keep up to date. I don't actually sync them, which is, I manually sync them at the end.
Are you using? Are you using DipTrace these days?
No, I'm still using Altium, unfortunately.
But, so Altium has a library manager that I've been using.
Oh, yeah, Altium's got advanced tools to take care of this shit, but, I just have never gotten to the point where I've needed to be invested enough to to do the upfront work to make all that seamless.
Yeah, so, that's the exact same problem I'm looking at, because it is so much and getting it all hooked up, you need someone to do that full-time for you, basically.
Exactly. If somebody else takes care of it, fine.
Right. And like we talked about earlier, if you're a company, that's $200,000, so you really got to need that. And oftentimes, it's just like you tell your engineers, no, you can handle that. Go ahead. You're fine.
Yeah. And I don't do enough designs, and the designs aren't hugely complex enough to warrant it, really. Right. So I just keep limping along,
Right,
wishing
exactly.
that I had some
cursing
automated
the whole
system,
time, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. 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 I know. And that's what you do. But sadly, that's what probably most people do.
Oh, yeah. I don't doubt it. I was complaining about it at my work, and basically, my mentor said to me, he's like, well, just connect to the dots. Come on, man. Just put the stuff down, connect the dots. You'll be fine. Just get it done.
Exactly.
It was pretty funny.
And in the end, that's what you just end up doing. You just end up doing it all manually. And, you'll make the odd mistake, but who cares? You just respin the board, It's like,
yeah, no big deal. I guess you're doing low quantities, yeah.
Big as well, getting it all right in your system's not a, not a guarantee that you're going to get your first spin right, especially if you're putting in 10 new parts,
That's true.
You can goof
That's
up
true.
There just as well as you can goofing up by doing the manual way. So, it's not a guaranteed success.
Mm, definitely. You can goof anything up, really.
Heck, I've had recently where, footprints are wrong. The pinouts in the schematic symbol are wrong. I've gotten them from the official library, right? I found, oh, great, my component's in the library, and then I've realized, oh, it's wrong. It's like, holy crap. If you can't trust the components in the official library, well, you shouldn't. That's the golden rule, right?
Yeah.
If the component's in there, it should be double checked. So that's why companies have blanket rules. Some companies have blanket rules where you do not use components that come from the Altium library or come from the Eagle library or whatever. You have to do it yourself, and then it has to be triple checked and signed off, and
paperwork.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Oh boy.
So not on the CAD side, but on the component side, actually, one of our listeners wrote on discussion board about stuff for actually managing your own stock at your house, actually. It's actually called the component organizer, and basically it's a way to keep track of your, what parts you have, if you have the data sheet, it links to that, how much you have in stock and everything.
I've kind of sort of implemented that in my home thing, but I just gave up. Now I just order on spec. If I'm producing another 200 microcurrents, I've got my BOM. I actually went to the trouble to put my BOM into DigiKey. Okay, and here's the advantage of being and buying all the parts from the one supplier, right? Mm. I buy all my parts from DigiKey, right? Yeah, it's more expensive, but I've actually went to the trouble to put my BOM into DigiKey, and now I just go order 200, bang, and it orders the correct quantity and done. Like, it takes me 5 minutes to order all those parts from DigiKey, and I don't have to worry about it. I know they're the correct type. I know they're the correct number. Everything's fine.
Have you run into any points where you're like, they're like, oh, well, we don't have those parts now?
No, I haven't. Okay. But it actually tells you that before you go before you hit the go button, it tells you live in the BOM whether or not right. they have stock. So
right.
Unfortunately, yeah, fortunately, I haven't hit that.
Yeah, I think this is more for you know, for your home stuff. So if you knew you had 15, you know, op amps in your house, right?
God, no.
Well, I know, but like, yeah. So you knew
who does that?
People. Some people are very. Okay. You know.
Right, anal about their parts collections. Huh?
If you were really good at it, you put little weight, you know, transducers inside each of your part bins, and you'd estimate how many are in there and feed it all back.
Well, you put barcodes on them and everything, scanners, and you'd have inventory, automated inventory systems.
The whole life would just be inventory stuff, right? No.
Well, I'd love to hear from anyone who actually takes that sort of thing. Seriously, I mean, well, I've just gotten some more parts bins, right, where I'm probably going to sit down one day when I've got some free time and go, right, these are, you know, linear regulators, and I'm going to put all my linear regulators in the linear regulator thing. At the moment, they're spread between different, I keep my components based on the project I worked on.
Right.
Right? So all the parts for that particular project are in a box, and, you know, so I've got to remember, I've got to keep it up in the gray matter up here where... You know, oh, yeah, I used that switch in reg over in that project 3 years ago, and it should be in that box, you know.
Well, that's good because you don't cannibalize your stock then, right? You won't necessarily exactly. I want to build this. Now it's.
So there's trade-offs both ways there. It's good that if you want to come back and work on that project, right, you've got all the parts in that one box. But it's bad if you're hacking something and you need that switch in regulator chip and you know you've got one somewhere, but where the hell is it?
Yeah, right, exactly.
You know, so. Yeah, like I like to keep all of the parts for the current projects I'm working on in a box, right? That way, you know, they're all there and, you know, you're done with. But I think once a project's been set aside or it's no longer worked on, I should actually take all the parts out and then put those in my general inventory.
Right, yeah.
So, I don't know. It's a tough call.
Well, once you hire an intern or something, you get the first task,
yeah.
Interns don't cost $200,000. They cost a lot less.
They only cost 20 or 30, right? No, here the minimum wage is like $30,000 or something, I think.
Is it really?
I'm not sure. And well, yeah, don't quote me on that, but it's, you know, it's certainly, I don't think it's 20.
I mean, around in the U.S., I mean, some interns don't even get paid at all.
Oh, wow. See, that's illegal here. No, I didn't.
I don't
know
how they get away with it, actually. I've seen some articles about how that's kind of a... crappy practice. I mean, a lot of engineering people, you know, like co-ops, a lot of times you'll get paid.
Right.
I think I wouldn't have done a co-op if I didn't get paid, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
But, you know, like it's pretty standard for a lot of even in engineering sometimes, you know, like if it's like a summer internship, sometimes those aren't paid. Usually when they're shorter term kind of things. But a lot of other industries, they definitely don't get paid. You know, like to the point where like marketing interns, they'll go and live in New York, you know, like New York City.
Right.
And
yeah.
Won't get
expensive,
paid.
Right?
Right. And it's like, well, some of them take out loans. That's pretty crappy. But.
Oh, or they go and work nights at.
I guess so. Yeah.
Some restaurant somewhere waiting tables. So
right. But yeah, it's just seen as a
rite of free internship.
Right. Exactly. It's just seen as a rite of passage. And it's like, well, that's a crappy system. So,
But it's a self-perpetuating system.
Of course it is. Yeah, I did it for free. Yeah. Why don't you do it for free, right?
Yeah, that's right. I paid my dues, you know.
Right, exactly.
Yep. Mm. No, I think that's mostly stamped out here. It's illegal, I think, unless it's some very specific circumstance or something. Yeah, I don't think that's the norm here.
Right.
Mm. Certainly not. Yep. There are probably ways around it, right? If you really wanted to work for free, you probably could. But,
right.
You know, I
guess it's not under the table if you're not paying. You don't have any taxes to pay when you're. You just kind of show up and you're like, oh, what do I want to do today?
Well, the tax-free threshold here in Australia, I think, is now up to. I think they're going to push it up to like $15,000 or something like that.
Mm.
So you can earn that much money a year, and you don't have to even file a tax return.
Mm.
You
know? Yeah, that's true. Yeah, no, they had that here, I guess, too, because I used to not have to when I was younger.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Well, when I was a boy, it started out at like $5,000 was the tax-free threshold.
Yeah.
So, but now I think it's like tripled or something. I don't know.
Kids these days, man, right?
Yeah, I know.
Right?
Got easy.
I'm so old now, man. Yeah.
Man. Jeez, they can earn, you know, if they can earn $15,000 a year without paying any tax. Jeez, my first job was only 20, 23,000 a year or something.
Really? They paid that much back in the Stone Age, huh?
Yeah. Well, they paid me in tablets, you know.
Right, of course, of course.
Yeah. Stone tablet with, you know, something chiseled out in there.
Yep.
IOU, you know. No, they actually paid cash back then, you know.
Really?
I'm sure we talked about it before.
Yes, we did.
Yeah, somebody would go to the... Somebody would ride shotgun with the secretary who would go to the bank, and they'd pick up the, you know, the weekly, I think it was weekly. They would pick up the weekly paychecks, and it was, you know, cash already sorted by the bank into all the envelopes with your name on it. You know, that was part of the when banks actually, you know, did some service back then, you know. And and you would get your little brown envelope with your pay slip and your cash.
Yep. And then you go to the bar.
Yeah. Oh boy. Yeah. Those were the days.
Mm-hmm.
Boy.
So we were speaking about parts before. And did you see Octopart actually started, one of their interns actually, I think, they came up with a new thing. They have historical pricing now. So you can see how much a part has cost over time. And it's, there we go. Greg Schickman, maybe? He said he's working at Octopart this summer as a software engineering intern. So he actually is the one working on, you know, working on this, I think, maybe try a trial thing. So you can actually go and look at, you know, they use the @Mega324, which is, you know, using a lot of
I'm
Arduinos.
Looking at that.
And
you can see the price drop when the Japanese earthquake happened.
Yeah.
What? I thought the prices would go up.
I thought so too, but maybe...
What?
I don't know. Pricing doesn't have to make sense. I mean...
They've got a Renesas part here, and there's a video which I watched the other week, which was the Renesas factory. It's on their YouTube account, and it showed what the aftermath of the earthquake was, and like all their fab lines, you know, and things, all these, you know, expensive machines just tipped over, you know, on the floor, and the roof caved in, and, you know, but they were back up and running in those fabs in like 3 months.
Right, yeah. They were a success story because then it was offset by that thing we talk about. Two weeks ago with them getting bought and chopped up and everything.
Yep.
Yeah.
And, and I found out, by the way, it didn't affect their microcontroller being, you know, effectively bought out. Didn't affect their microcontroller division. It's all to do with other divisions. Apparently the microcontroller one is completely safe.
Okay, cool.
They don't even know anything's happening, you know, so. But cool. Apparently they're going to lay off a third of the workforce, but the microcontroller Bob's just, you know.
Yeah.
No.
Well, that's
doing
probably
fine.
Their cash cow, right? I mean, that's probably where they're...
Yeah,
well... Because they're one of the biggest in the world, right?
They are the biggest microcontroller manufacturer
the
in the world, yes. Yes, the biggest.
Wow.
Yeah, bigger. You know, everyone talks about Atmel and Microchip. No, they're not the biggest, you know?
Right.
TI, right. No, they're not the biggest.
It's all volume. It's all in consumer devices and stuff.
It's all in the automotive and the dishwashers and the fridges and, stuff like that.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, so this is pretty interesting, though, being able to see the prices. I don't know if you'd actually be able to use it as a predictor. You know, like maybe if you started seeing trends over years and, prices start to drop in, you know, March because people are, because certain products don't do well. But either way, it's interesting. You know, you can see a band. You could really use it as an error band of how much it might go up total. You know, like really you'd think prices would go down over time, but that's not necessarily true because... I mean, you could have been using a @Mega324 6 years ago, right? You're like, this is probably going to get cheaper. And then Arduinos start taking off and, demand goes up a little bit.
Is that index adjusted? Is all this stuff index adjusted? So it's, you know, like, it's actually not dollars from 10 years ago. It's actually in today's dollars, kind of.
I don't know.
You know, has it got that relative
adjustment
thing based on the CPI and all that?
Right. I don't... think so, maybe.
Anyway, the price did go up, due to the Japanese earthquake. All I saw was the end of the graph, which is the big drop, whoosh,
right
down. But it ramped up immediately, like it was flat, and then the earthquake happened, and it ramped up from like, you know, $16 a chip to, you know, $30 a chip or something, and then lasted for a couple of months, and then plummeted.
Right. I remember I was upset on the show about that, because the number one response to that was, you know, all the buyers... being like, well, what's going to happen to our supply, right? It was a very predictable response from the buyers, but I was upset that it was very inhumane kind of response, right?
Well, but you know, you've got to keep the two separate.
No, and I know. Right? I've since come to terms with it, but yeah.
You know, yes.
Some of the buyers I knew, they were scrambling. They were going bonkers.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, it's a huge part. You know, like we talk about electronics on the show, but buying the parts is sometimes the hardest thing of it. You know, like it's crazy.
And when you've got to, and unfortunately, as a one-man band designer, you've got to take that into account. You know, if you're you know, looking to get on Kickstarter and, you know, following Marcus's footsteps and getting, you know, even if you're looking at getting 1,000 made, you've got to choose those parts wisely.
Yep. Yeah.
Because if you choose the wrong one and you're stuck with a, you know, you're single sourced and you can't second source that sucker and you're stuck with a 3-month lead time, you are screwed.
Right.
You know, you'd almost have to respin your board. You'd have to respin your design just to get out of the shit you're in.
Yeah. Are you seeing stuff? See, the thing is, like, I've been talking to people about, you know, single sourcing, multi sourcing parts lately for these designs I'm doing, and it's like, is it even possible anymore unless you actually degrade the performance of what you're working on? I mean, like, if you're using 7.4 series logic, then yeah, okay, you can get second sources. But, you know, if you're using any kind of A to D or any kind of, you know, like, even op-amps now, like, they use different packaging.
See, op-amp, you know, well, there is. Yeah, if you go for the weird-ass BGA ones or something like that. But, you know, if you're using, like, your standard SO8 or SO14 op-amp or your, you know, and second source doesn't necessarily mean a different manufacturer, right? A different, you know.
Different, you're right. There could be different versions.
It can mean the same manufacturer,
flavors.
But they've got different performance parts, you know, and yeah, you may be able to get out of the shit by buying the higher performance part. You're paying more for it, but at least, you know, you don't have to wait 3 months for it because it's available. Yeah. So you can look at that. Oh, yeah, there's a higher priced option available. I don't like it, but it would get me out of the shit if I had to.
That's true. So, yeah, no, that's a good point. I mean, yeah, I guess, but even still, I mean, I always hear second source and I immediately think of, you know, like, you know how like chip companies used to do it. They would just straight up copy each other. There was like was no beans about it. It was just, yeah, oh, you're making that part, we're making that now too, we're second source, right? And you just don't see that as much anymore because of patents on footprint technology or on packaging technology, and footprints are different.
That's evil. Yeah, that's evil shit.
Yeah, it's
not
maybe there's
there.
Maybe there's a business opportunity for someone to like be the middleman, you know, like doing like a pad reversal of, you know, like just doing little crossover boards where you're just, you know, like rerouting pads. That'd be kind of cool, but I don't know.
Well, that's the other way to do it, but then that sucks ass with SMD, you know?
Oh, that's true, yeah.
So, but if you go for like a large SO package, say, then you can make an SMD adapter board where you have like the half moon pads on the side of the board and you can mount it flat on the SO footprint and then mount the little tiny pain in the ass BGA package on top, you know, if you had to.
Well, it seems like it's getting worse with, you know, as manufacturers go into smaller packages. I mean, I know there are standards, it's smaller ones, right? There's like SC70s and everything else and all the SOT23-whatevers, but, and I know those are smaller, but it seems like as you get smaller geometries now on the pads, it's just because there's more research in it, it's just they're going non-standard, and I wish there was something we could do to try and force standardization, but I don't know what it is yet, you know, other than I whine at reps every time. I'm like, well, I'd love to see this in a standard pinout, and they all chuckle and say, oh yeah, of course, right? You know, screw you.
Right.
I know your game, and I don't like it.
Well, that's what you got. You know, that's all you can do is call them out on it, and you know, piss and moan and rant until the cows come home.
That's what we do around here.
It's like, you know, Milton down. Someone stole my stapler. My stapler, you know, but nobody's listening. Nobody's listening to me. Oh, boy.
Yep.
Yeah. Tragic.
Yeah. Well, speaking of chip makers, there's actually an interesting link I found on anysilicon.com, which is a new site I'd never heard of before. But actually, so, you know, like a lot of companies are going to the fab model, right? And we talked about, I complained on here about Analog Devices going to the fab model. And and actually, there's a video that I found of shoot, what's his name? Bob Joe Dobkin. Bloggs. No, Bob Dobkin.
Oh, Bob Dobkin.
CTO of Linear Tech. Right, he's an awesome guy. He's in the
and
same.
And he does lots of videos.
Lots of videos.
Apparently.
He does lots of. He still makes chips. I mean, like, he's awesome. So
I have to get him on the show.
Oh, I'd love to get him on the show. But anyways, he talks about that too. And granted, like, you kind of have to read between the lines there because Linear Tech does have their own fab, so they're trying to push that as like, oh well, we're different now. But he talks about, you know, the same thing of going to foundries now and like with the analog stuff and how that's kind of mm-hmm. kind of dicey. So I'm not off my rocker here. I got Bob Dobkin behind me. You know, I sort of kind of know what I'm talking about. But this this AnySilicon.com, right? They the author of the site actually shows a chart of the different foundries out there, right? And there's actually a bunch. There's Cytera, there's Tower Jazz, there's UMC, there's TSMC, there's Dongbu Hightech, right? And then the newest one is
Gesundheit.
Yeah, right. Is the Global Foundries. That's actually a shared research base between like AMD and a couple other people. I think I could be wrong about that. I know they have a new place up in upstate New York because one of my former coworkers works there now. Anyway, this you know, like you hear all these names, right? It's like, okay, well, there's foundries. And this thing, though, it's crazy. You look at like the relative business levels, right? Especially over time. And it's like, you know, you got the little ones, and then you get Global Foundries, which is pretty big. And then you get UMC, which is out of Taiwan. And I think they might have some stuff in Shanghai. And then you have TSMC, and it's just like TSMC is probably 90% of the business. And it's just like, holy crap. Oh man. So it's a very interesting chart because, you know, you think about, we talked on this past shows about if you did have to finally throw your design to someone, mm-hmm. well, the reason they're so big is because they're getting all the big boys, right? They're getting the Apples and everybody else, right? But so you're never going to get in there. So you might have some luck, but it just shows just how big of a scale difference it is. You know, like, It's insane. It's honestly 90% of the business. So
oh boy.
But yeah, it's an interesting chart. People should check it out.
You'd have to be mad to go into that business, I think. Semiconductor business. Yeah. Oh man.
Yeah.
Why would you? Can't
call me when the garage
the
chip printer's available, right, Dave? I mean, honestly, like even then, I mean, it would be like Marcus sitting in my garage printing for 4 days
You'll
straight.
You'll be filing each individual chip down, you know.
Yeah. Oh yeah, it's
looking
it's,
through each one through a microscope.
Yeah, it's a tough business, you know. It's,
oh man,
it's not. I don't know why people do it either. I think because it must look good on paper, and I mean there is a lot of money to be made, right? Chips aren't going away anytime soon, but yeah, it's not easy.
Well, some people get off on that sort of thing, you know, managing huge, complex, you know, and it doesn't get much more complex than a chip fab, right?
That's
in
true.
Terms of, you know, scale. I mean, actually, what else rivals? Here's an interesting question. What else rivals a chip fab in terms of cost to set up the fab and just the sheer technology and the trickiness to maintain it and run it?
Mm.
You know, the only, maybe you might it's talk like, about it, you know, a car manufacturing plant with all their robots to, but it's, you know, I don't think they cost $10 billion to set up, do they?
No, I don't think so.
To set up, you know, and they got big, you know, you can walk in there with your big wrench and, you know, your monkey wrench and you can fix anything, right?
Right, you don't have to worry about dust falling on your car, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you don't need air filtration and everything else.
Yeah,
and
it's probably the most complex business in the world, surely, manufacturing silicon. It's gotta be.
Yeah.
I don't know anything.
I'm trying to think about it. I mean, like there's comparable stuff, right? I mean, like you think about like certain surgeries or like that. I mean, like healthcare could be said, but I mean,
well, no, but even, in the end, in a surgery, you know, you get a wise old guy with strokes his gray beard and cuts you open and fixes you, right? With basic, you know, 18th century tools, right? Effectively, right?
Yeah,
you know,
I'm
you've
not
got a scalpel.
Yeah.
You know, have you seen how they cut your chest open to do open heart surgery? Right, it's a big saw.
Yeah,
that's
true.
I mean, it's not some precision freaking laser.
And chip fabs are a lot cleaner than operating rooms too. If you didn't know.
Oh, of course. Yeah. you know. Anyone can walk in the operating room as long as you've got a mask on, you know.
Right.
Yeah. I don't think anything rivals it.
I mean, yeah. I've been there. I mean, I've been on the easier, quote unquote, easier side of memory, right? I mean, not even on the logic side, and that's 300 steps. I mean, that's I'm really racking my brain. I can't think of it. If people start a thread and discuss forum, and we'll see if anyone knows. I mean, because maybe there's something, but I don't know.
No, I'm betting there's not.
Yeah,
I'm shooting from the hip and betting there's not.
No, that's all. That's the only way you shoot.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, speaking of fabs and components, actually, Wired had an article about HP memristors, and they're claiming that their memristor is going to reinvent computer memory by 2014. That's kind of a tall order, I think.
That's pretty close.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. It'll take you at least that long to sort out the production, any production issues, let alone come on.
Well, they're saying they're 2.5 years away. I mean, they're working with people like GlobalFoundries.
Tell them he's dreaming.
Well, hey, I'd love to see it, but I mean, the thing is, there's going to be all these entrenched players like the Samsungs with their flash and magnetic memory, MRAM, and PRAM, and all those others. You know, like all these flash and DRAM manufacturers, they're not going to give up without a fight. So, to the point where they'll try and price the HP out of the market, right? I mean, so it's got to be really cheap. I mean, it's just like what the hard drive manufacturers have done. I mean, hard drives are still around, right? They've been saying for years and years and years, oh, well, SSDs are going to take over, but hard drive manufacturers just keep figuring out. So I'm sure the memristor has a ways to go.
Yeah, no, they've got a long way to go because, you know, you can't compete. But how long have they been doing flash RAM, for example? You know,
Flash has been around for 20 years, I think.
You cannot compete with that sort of development and refinement. And I'm sure, you know, they've got some tricks up their sleeves where they can lower cost, improve yield, yada, yada.
Yeah.
So, you know, lower profit margins if you have to, you said, to the death, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. A quote from this says, development costs at least 10 times as much as research, and commercialization costs 10 times as much as development. So in the end, research, which we think is the most important part, is only 1% of the effort. And I'm sure all our listeners feel that pretty hard, right? I mean, no one has the same marketing budget as they do engineering budget. And
have they even produced these things on the scale required? Like, as in, you know, the 10 megabit kind of, you know, the, like the huge densities required. I mean, it's one thing to do it in the research lab and you've got your 2 kilobyte memory, woo, but you're not going to take the world on, you know, you're not going to set the world on fire by selling 2 kilobyte chips.
Right, yeah, you're going to be real, you know, niche kind of player there.
Yeah.
But they're working, actually, it was Hynix, actually, not UMC or GlobalFoundries, but yeah, I think they have some. I knew that because it was 08 that they actually had the first ones. And then, you know, they've actually started. I think they've actually started making them. But they said the hardware is going to arrive in 2013. So we'll see.
Right.
I don't know.
It'd be the mythical engineering sample.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
If you've ever gotten engineering samples before, you know, pre-production samples.
I have not actually gotten them before.
I've used pre-production silicon.
Yeah. For what kind of silicon though? Like, are we talking like microchips or are we talking?
We're talking analog to digital converters.
Okay. So nothing like where it's you're gonna have an errata sheet like as long as your leg.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was finding. You know, you're used as the guinea pig to find the bugs. You know,
right.
All the bugs in detail to.
Really? Why would you do?
I'm just pumping this thing with random data to see what happens to the thing as well. You know, I got to a point where, well, you know, I'm going to force this thing to fail and figure out where it's going to. So I'm doing their job for them.
Did you know you'd have to do that going in?
No, it was like, a data sheet, which, you know, you had a pre-production data sheet, which listed all the nice specs, and you think everything's hunky-dory, and you get the part, and well, you know.
Yeah, not so much.
it doesn't quite work as expected.
Right, yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Past success is no indication of future success, right. That kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Oh boy.
Well, we should get running.
We should tell people who's on next week.
Oh, we should. Yes. Speaking of Wired.com, we will be having Chris Anderson, the editor of Wired.com, next week, and he also runs 3D Robotics, which is the commercial arm of DIY Drones. And he's wrote a bunch of books, and actually they just announced another book called The Makers, The Next Revolution, or something like that. And
sweet.
He's going to be an awesome guest, I think. So
I think so.
I'm really looking forward. We're going to try. So I got to discuss
what
for him.
What do we ask him about?
Oh, I think electronics.
He's into so many.
Yeah.
Well, we're an electronic show, supposedly, so
right.
Yeah, it makes
sense. And I posted a new thread in the Discuss forum just for an easy way to people to ask him questions and vote up other questions and stuff like that. But I did say in there, you know, like, yes, he's written all these books on the internet, but I don't think we'll have time to ask about that. You know, well,
no, I think we... Yeah.
Right. I mean, he's in the maker scene, and they run tons of boards, so... I think that's going to be the most interesting things we could ask him, because he's done tons of other interviews about the other stuff. So,
yeah, it's like, you know, imagine if we had, say, the had on the show the Woz, right? Would you ask him about all the Apple stuff?
No.
Probably not. You know, he's done like a million interviews.
Right,
you know?
Exactly.
You would sort of ask him about, you know, the electronics.
Right, exactly.
Hobby.
What he's doing these days, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Cool. So, yeah. Chris will be on next week. I'm really looking forward to that. In the meantime, people can follow us on Twitter, on Facebook, on Google+, and they can rate us on iTunes or any other of the other... we haven't asked that
in a while. That's a new one. Rate us.
Yeah, rate us or review us on iTunes. That's really helpful. We really appreciate that when people do that. It takes about 2 minutes. If you run iTunes, I don't run iTunes, but there's other platforms where you can rate shows as well, if you use Stitcher or anything else like that. So we really appreciate that when people do it. That's all I got. What about you, Dave?
Nah.
All right.
I'm done.
Cool. We'll talk to you next week.
See ya.